take me somewhere far away, to a true elsewhere.
We're Lucy and Robin, and we'll be your guides through Clamp's Wonderland.
So, Lucy's married now.
Yeah! May was a wild month, but mostly fun, and now we're here!
Your wedding was so beautiful. There was a lightsaber battle, and I cried so much.
Thank you. Yes, there was. We tried to have fun with it. I mean, who wants a normal first dance when you can start it out as a lightsaber battle? Anyway, I am so excited, Robin, to be at Clover. At last!
At
we
last.
Did it! We got here!
Oh my goodness. I'm so ready for this.
Oh, I know. And I can never quite remember like which Clamp series I read before which other Clamp series, but I know Clover stood out for a few obvious reasons, maybe obvious reasons, I guess. And I feel like I read it around the time that I started to like connect the dots that Clamp was a specific set of authors that were doing things I had read different things of. Like, it's when it all kind of started to come and make sense in my mind.
Yeah, no, that's funny. Because, like, as you're saying that, I'm like, oh man, I wonder if it was like that for me too.
Yeah, and I mean, it's hard to tell because a lot of, when Tokyo Pop and maybe other publishers were bringing a lot of Clamp to us in, like, the 2000s, it was all happening pretty quickly and around the same time, so it's kind of hard to trace that. Like, Ray Earth had been out here for a while, and X had been going, but there was kind of an influx of their older stuff, and I don't remember if Clover quite, like, lined up with that. So, I don't know. But to me, Clover kind of really bridges Clamp's different styles. Like, it's visually light and airy in a lot of ways, like Cardcaptor Sakura, but it's got that darker tone and still, like, a lot of use of black. And kind of a gritty sci-fi edge that really reminds me of X at moments. Plus, it's just gorgeous. Like, so gorgeous. Like, when people discuss the power of, like, sequential art, I think of Clover. Like, it just kind of stands out. And, I mean, all manga is art, and all comics are art, but it just kind of feels elevated to me.
Yeah, there is a reason this is, like, my top fave, right, with Tokyo Babylon, right? Like, it's really, really special. All right, so Lucy, place us in our Clamp timeline.
All right. Clover started in 1997, only a year after Cardcaptor Sakura started, give or take a few months. They ran concurrently for a while, with Clover going on hiatus in 1999 and Cardcaptor Sakura ending in 2000.
More on that hiatus later.
1997 is also when we get the Ray Earth OVA and the Clamp School Detectives anime, followed by the Cardcaptor Sakura anime in 1998. Also, the X manga is still running and would continue until 2003, which I think matters because it's easy to think of X as being in the past with Ray Earth or all the Clamp School crossovers, but it's very much still contemporary, and I think you can see similarities between Clover and this era of X. Speaking of remembering all that, Reg Veda ran until 1996, so these series are all a lot more contemporary than we, or at least I, often think of them being. It can feel like Clover is a bit of a return to form after Cardcaptor Sakura with a darker tone, but really Clamp has always been writing their darker stuff alongside their lighter stuff. It's just easy to lose track of that when we're going one series at a time like we have been.
Yeah. There's definitely a version of this podcast that would be just awful, where we like read like chapter by chapter everything as chapters come out of all of the different comics, and that would just be incomprehensible and funny, because like that's of course how people actually read. Like in real life you read things as they come out, but oh boy, what a jumble. Like that's decidedly not what we're doing here.
Yeah, there's a time and place for that, and if somebody wants to make that podcast, I will happily listen.
Oh, y'all
to
listen
it
to that. Yeah. I don't want to make it.
No. It would be so interesting.
So Clover itself is a 4-volume series so far, often collected in omnibus form. There is currently one available from Dark Horse in the US and Kodansha in Japan. It ran from 1997 to 1999 in a now-defunct Kodansha magazine called Amie. I can't pronounce French, I'm sorry. It's friend in French, just like Nakayoshi is you know, friend in Japanese, right? And of course, it was aimed at girls who just outgrown Nakayoshi, which has been published since the early 20th century for elementary school girls. And of course, you know, Cardcaptor Sakura and Ray Earth and Sailor Moon all ran in Nakayoshi. Probably the most famous thing from Ami is Clover. there's something called Juline that I think we may have gotten thanks to Tokyo Pop and the Manga Boom. Something I've never heard of called Nervose Venus. But it did not last for an incredibly long time, and I had a really hard time finding much of anything about it. From their interview in the Clamp no Kiseki issue about Clover, remember that series from the late 2000s where Clamp did a little revisitation of all their different series and had the little chess pieces with it? We refer to them a lot because they're very information dense. I'm sure we will, and you will hear a lot about it from this. but from that one, I think that they said that they were pitching this comic when the magazine started. I can't quite glean whether I understood that perfectly, but it sounds like maybe Ami was starting and they pitched this as something for it, and like that would mean that that magazine lasted for like barely 3 years, right? It also may have been the magazine rebranding or trying to reinvigorate itself when they pitched, but it definitely sounded like the pitch that they did was like a significant moment for the magazine, where the magazine was like, oh, we need something from you, which would make sense because they had, you know, been creating important stuff for Nakayoshi. They had a couple different ideas using the same characters, very Clamp, right, with their star system. and interesting to see this, like, they describe this as a character-driven story, which audience, let us know. Like, I guess it is, but I still think of it as maybe less so than some of their work. But the concept of escaping from a facility together was the image that they planted. Like, that was the thing in their minds that they wanted to do something with. Okawa also says in an interview that Clover was inspired by a dream, which checks out for me. There is something dreamy about it, although it is very grounded and gritty in many ways, too. Clover was published, as far as I could tell, in like micro chapters of only a very few sparse, atmospheric, often panel borderless pages. It must have been very beautiful in the magazine, almost just like graphic design layout illustrations. At the time, music journalism and printed lyrics on fold-out CD booklets were a major source of accessible art and design in young people's lives. So it tracks for me that this is so visually tied to that kind of stuff, especially because it is very music-oriented, as you will find out as we discuss what's actually in it. But this is another Clamp manga that remains technically unfinished. Ami folded in 1999, and Clover folded with it, even though Okawa has always maintained that they needed two more volumes to finish the full story. I read and loved it not knowing that, and so have hundreds of thousands of others, so I'd maintain that it does stand on its own as is, though I am dying for more and may just have to die never knowing. Still, the name Clover was something they came up with knowing the story would be in four parts. Like a four-leaf clover, the leaves of clover plants are a major motif in the series. So the four volumes we have are parts 1 through 3. It is a sci-fi story, very much a cyberpunk Y2K vibe about psychics and a dystopian future. By Y2K, I do mean turn of the last century, year 2000, which is long enough ago that we can look back and see its salient features and qualities, which we'll explore as we read. But maybe a brief note on cyberpunk. This term, like anything that people plaster over genres of lit, art, fashion, film, etc., can mean a lot of things. But in this case, I mean sci-fi concerned with anxiety about technology as it was changing in the 80s through 2000s, especially regarding the digital age, computers, and the internet, and how they erased some boundaries and created other ones. The punk part implies a certain amount of fighting the system and ground-up underdog-type focus rather than a quasi-utopian, imagine how good we can make the future if we all behave and allow technology's role to grow however the people in charge want. But we call something cyberpunk that don't push back quite so much. The cyberpunk TTRPG series created by Mike Pondsmith did a lot to cement its tropes and aesthetics and just the term in nerd culture, but the term seems to have been introduced via the title of a short story by Bruce Bethke that came out in a 1983 issue of the genre magazine Amazing Stories. And William Gibson's Neuromancer from 1983 was a huge touchstone for the genre and for that, but probably Ridley Scott's visionary film adaptation of Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, aka Blade Runner, from 1992, is probably the standout cyberpunk originator to point to. And it was hugely influential all over the world, even if it's now often criticized for Orientalism and generally playing into, like, 70s and 80s Western racist anxieties about Eastern countries' growing role in the global economy. See also criticism of William Gibson's entire body of work and Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash and etc. But at the time, Blade Runner, and really those other folks' work as well, showed a richly realized world where Asian cultures had a huge presence in the future instead of the world being a whitewashed monoculture. We'll definitely be coming back to Blade Runner in future episodes, but its influence on Clover is apparent, let's say. They said that in that same Clamp Nokiseki interview that they watched 1984 for tone and visuals, as well as just looking at photos of German factories, etc. It has an almost European-looking backdrop and a timeless retro future. And it has some of the most exquisite art and page layouts that child me had ever experienced. A massive shift from the lush, almost overworked, ink-soaked pages of X, and even the less ink-soaked but very flowery and peppy pages of Cardcaptor Sakura. I can't wait to talk about this comic on a technical level as well as story level, because both are so lovely, so I really incorporate both of those even into the summary, so hopefully that is fun for everybody to listen to. Okawa often says that even as a writer, she has a hand in the primary layouts, where you, like, sketch a page, often placing dialogue and text balloons, figuring out how many panels and what shape, size, and where characters and elements will appear in them. It's honestly the hardest part for me. The primary decision-making load is in this first stage. Even before Makona works on pages, Okawa will have some part of that, not just writing a script. And for Clover, she says she helped Makona extensively. They work together back and forth because Clover is built around song lyrics, and laying those out effectively is part of the page, so they're actually visually part of the action, or the structure on which the action is hung, is super difficult. And that was apparently Okawa's idea. They said they had music videos and cinema in mind, letting those kinds of flowing, sequential, or splashy images take the lead rather than panel-based comic storytelling. The thin, elegant lines for panels were aesthetically pretty for the Shoujo magazine, but they have the effect of being barely there, barely separating images from each other, making the stark artwork and the big negative spaces feel flowier than that would usually be. Or the panel lines are almost all that there is. That's also a fun thing they do here. I am a very digital artist. I was always intimidated by traditional media, and I rarely use tools properly, even when I'm doing watercolors and stuff now. But as I'm watching my little brother, Alan Kaplan, AL Comics, ink pro comics traditionally, he has been using all kinds of tools that American and Japanese and European, et cetera, comics artists have been using for decades. And it's been cool to see how much they matter for how the mark making actually turns out. Brushings for filling areas, China marker to get texture. It's cool to get to know which tools do what. And this era in the late 90s, still an era where Clamp were pretty cutting edge with their art supplies. They were using airbrush and Copic markers instead of watercolor for a lot of their illustrations. You know, they have all this like photo bashing technique that I keep talking about for background elements and sometimes just having repeated elements. They were always experimenting with which kinds of pens and ink they liked on which kinds of paper. For Clover, Clamp explained they used gayoshi, which I'm pretty sure is like crappy construction paper or drafting paper, to get the look they wanted for the inks. The interview in the Clover Camp Nokiseki volume cites achieving the special bounciness of the main character's hair, which is short and white like clover flowers, but they curse that screen tones didn't want to stick to it, which tracks and may explain why they use so few screen tones in Clover. The Tankobon, the trade paperbacks editions, are also just beautifully designed as books. The covers of the original Japanese volumes were replicated by the old Tokyopop release, by the way. So even in the US, we got these premium print copies that were impossible to resist, though a little spendy, for so many of us back in the day. The book had printed covers, plus a printed vellum dust cover with all the text on it. It adds this extra luxurious layer, obscuring the cover images behind, like, a curtain of fog or mist. We'd never seen anything like this before, and boy did our copies not survive pristinely through the years, but I still have them and treasure them.
Oh man, that is for real, though. Like, I'm usually pretty gentle on books.
No, like, Lucy, your books always look pristine in ways I cannot possibly maintain, even when I desperately try. You don't break book spines, like, even for comics, which you have to open to see the middle, to see the work near the gutter, like, you're crazy.
But even my first volume of Clover definitely has some dings and bent edges for the dust jacket on the first volume. I was much more careful with the later volumes, but that first one was just so unlike anything I'd ever encountered, and really unlike much I've seen to this day. So much more delicate than the usual dust jacket you get on, like, a hardback book. I mean, we all have mixed feelings about Tokyo Pop, I'm sure, but in this era, they were trying really hard to bring the things over in as close to the same style as they were released in Japan, and I really appreciate that.
Clover stands out to many overseas fans, and I know from my informal observance of artist alleys back in the 2000s that the artwork at least drove a lot of illustrators to draw mechanical Baroque bird wings on their characters, if nothing else. But what of the story?
Oh.
By the time the first volume's comic panels begin, we've had multiple pages of lyrical buildup, starting with the vellum cover's front flap, which has yearning song lyrics that continue over onto the title page with two important lines, "So take me someplace far away," and "I want happiness." We're then treated to a lavish full-color spread of two characters lying on their backs, close but not necessarily romantically entwined, looking up as if at the camera. A man with glasses dressed in black, and a young woman with short white hair dressed in white and gold. Then the chapter index, looking like a poem in itself, and with the original kanji preserved, at least in my volume. And then, the way Blade Runner or Terminator has an opening crawl that explains just a hint of backstory, we get a little text and one enigmatic image of a four-leaf clover made of entwined, wired tech detritus, maybe buttons or lights or gears. The text teases us. They say a four-leaf clover brings happiness. But don't tell anyone whether clovers bloom white flowers or how many leaves from its stem extend. A four-leaf clover. I only want your happiness, but I cannot be yours.
And I am reading the hardcover omnibus. It was released in, like, 2020. It doesn't have the vellum cover, but it does include a number of glossy full-color prints in the beginning of the book. Not that beautiful two-page spread, though, and I can't remember if it's got the kanji intact. It does a little bit more translating, I think.
Interesting.
It still looks very beautiful, and it is bigger, which I appreciate for the art.
Yeah, no, I think I would like to have a copy of an omnibus just to be able to see pages bigger, but I treasure that I still have my original copies.
Yeah, they are still beautiful.
All right, so then we join a conversation already in progress. An old woman in an ornate hooded garment with a lot of wires coming out of the back, very City of Lost Children, but pretty, named General Ko, is trying to convince the man in black, from that earlier image, to come back to work for the government.
His name is Kazuhiko Feiru, and he owes her for how many times she apparently saved his ass, at least 6 court-martials back in the day. She threatens to play back a memory chip of her exasperation with him at the 6th court-martial, so that's our first hint about what is possible in this world. He's a civilian now, and insists this is his last mission. And she insists he's the only man for this job, and she knows he can keep a secret. She transmits, palm to palm, a cryptogram that appears to be a leaf into Kazuhiko's hand. It'll dissolve when he's completed his mission, delivering a package. Kazuhiko walks away from an almost Tokyo Tower-shaped smear of light down a city street. We see crowds of people in a packed skyline, and a statue of a fairy-like winged girl on a pillar with clover written in script at the base. He walks past a bank of screens all showing that statue, which is singing lyrics we already may find familiar. I wish for happiness. I seek happiness. To find happiness with you.
Cut to Kazuhiko taking off his glove so a strange lock can scan the cryptogram leaf in his palm. He's admitted to a giant greenhouse or conservatory shaped like a birdcage, conveyed to his destination by an Alice in Wonderland-style dressed-up white rabbit. There are other animals in clothing, too, and Kazuhiko calls them late-model killer dolls, evidence that whatever he's supposed to be picking up and delivering, someone is really invested in protecting it. Only to find it's not a whatever, but whoever. Perched on a tree branch is a young woman with white hair, wearing white lace and Baroque mechanical wings on her back. She is singing that same song, "I Wish for Happiness," and mechanical winged birds flutter past her. The two make eye contact, There's a flutter of white lace, birds flying, and their hands meet as she descends from her perch. "Are you the one who will take me?" she asks.
He sure is. Kazuhiko takes her to see an old military buddy, Gengetsu, who has a visor that makes him look like Cyclops from X-Men and shoulders even wider than Kazuhiko's, and his partner, a languid young man named Lan. The reason we're here, other than to trade salty banter with the two, is because Sue needs to get to a place called Fairy Park, and that's out of the country, too arduous to do on foot. They need Lan to help. How? Well, he does seem to turn the radio to Sue's favorite song with just a gesture, though that could be how radios work in the future. But it's actually because he can operate his modified local transport module, which looks like a wireframe cube or maybe a Faraday cage, to get them to their destination faster than an instant travel transporter.
Sue doesn't know what that is either, but apparently they're everyday tech here.
Gengetsu hands a sort of medallion over to Kazuhiko, a military-grade weapons module that he figures he'll need if this is a General Cole joint. Kazuhiko lost his hand on the last job. He says he hopes this one is that easy. And Lan transports them. This is shown by him donning VR gear and virtually shifting parts of a 3D cube, expertly portrayed with screen tones, I believe, like he's solving a holographic Rubik's Cube, while Kazuhiko and Sue's bodies unravel like ribbons off a spool. But something goes wrong. They're intercepted, disappearing off to who knows where, and the module loses cohesion, collapsing. Lan also collapses into Gengetsu's waiting arms. He's trying to track them down, but he's also concerned about that girl.
We get more glimpses of the fairy girl statue singing that same song, glimpses of the metal band on Sue's thigh, green leaves, a clover leaf, and then they're somewhere. Not Fairy Park, but a Chinatown-like area, maybe a slum, rubble and neon signs and laundry lines hanging up everywhere. Sue has a large suitcase that we hadn't really seen before. Unfortunately, there are also soldiers in helmets surrounding them. Kazuhiko activates the little medallion and his arm transforms into a birdbeak-like metal shape with angular petals that fold in to make a giant saber. A soldier lays their hand on Sue's shoulder and he hacks it off, throwing away the offending appendage, and they hoof it. He offers to carry the suitcase, but she refuses the help. She's more worried about his hand, which seems to be on the fritz. He says it's fine, a top-quality military-issued artificial hand. He's trying to contact Lan, but can't get through. And they've run right into some new goons. These have a vaguely 80s Hong Kong crime movie motif going on, and they're all pointing what I think are tonfa at the pair. Sue, growing to trust and rely on her protector, huddles into his arms.
They're taken before a small child with a bowl cut and cyberpunk goggles, sitting on a floating chair that might be his crime boss throne. He has a pretty lady attendant and a cat with a lot of cyberpunk accessories. This is the leader of the rebel militia, Shao Mao, and he's impressed that Sue can tell the cat is a real cat, not the cyborg it's dressed up as. Sue and the cat bond by meowing at each other, which is very relatable. This is how I approach cats. Kazuhiko avoids answering too many probing questions about what they're doing in his territory by claiming they're on a date, which Sue doesn't know how to play along with. They're stuck on the wrong side of the border still, and now they're really stuck in a bare-bones hotel room being used as a holding cell where the captors investigate further. The room does have a radio, and it picks up the song. Sue sings along to it, and Kazuhiko claps, telling her she sings well. She's surprised. No one's ever clapped for her. She was all alone in the greenhouse. Kazuhiko asks if she was born there or was put there, but no. On a full-page spread of Sue looking lost and distant, she says she chose to be there, and the song lyrics take over the page. Take me somewhere far from here, take me away, an unbreakable spell, a never-ending kiss, an endless dream, eternal happiness, please take me away.
As he watches over her sleeping form, Kazuhiko reviews the situation. Lan couldn't have messed up. This was interference. Someone has machinations on Sue. The soldiers who attacked them first were Black Ops Isaian Army, which means they're an Isaiah. He looks at his hand, thinking about how that's not a place he really wants to be. And someone is watching him. Footage of him, that is, from the last battle. This is someone from the Isaian Army who knows Kazuhiko quite well. He can trace him by the radiation from his weapon module, and he's hot on his trail, calling him his little prince. In the morning, Sue and Kazuhiko start to talk about Lan and Gengetsu a little, but their door is thrown open by our tiny Xiaomiao warlord. He knows who Kazuhiko Fei Yu is now, a legend to them, and says that someone is here to see him, but they'll let Kazuhiko and Sue escape to repay him for not just decimating his soldiers when they first arrived. Sue and the cat say their goodbyes to each other, and the pretty lady assistant gives them a little plum or peach blossom branch, telling them to have fun on their date. And then they're off, walking away to a flickering screen in the middle, playing video of the fairy singing that song.
Meanwhile, General Ko seems to be one of five old cyberpunk wizards discussing the situation. The Azaean army is on the offensive. Sue isn't going to stay a secret for long, and while maybe they should have picked reliable old Gengetsu, Ko insists that only Kazuhiko can deliver her. Also, meanwhile, Lan is still trying to get in touch with Kazuhiko, and he's still preoccupied with something he's gleaned. Is there really such a thing as a four-leaf clover? He touches this one spot on his shoulder, and we see a panel of just Sue's leg where she has the metal band. But Sue and Kazuhiko still can't get through to Lan, and they really need his help. Without it, they're struck trying other methods of transportation, like the beautiful fish-like zeppelin they book tickets on, which I swear is a Rayearth reference. It totally looks like the flying fish. Fight me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, they even call it, like, the chapter title is, like, flying fish flying through the night or something. So, no, I think that they love the idea of a flying fish zeppelin. I think you're good.
I love the idea also. It's Sue's first time on one, and she's also very impressed. There doesn't seem to be anyone else on board, but they can play the same song there with the fairy singer hologram. Kazuhiko asks if she likes this song, and she's non-committal about it. He smokes as they listen to the words. The birds sing a song in a foreign tongue, in a place where wings are not enough, a place not reachable alone, so please take me somewhere far from here.
Kazuhiko notices her eyes are evergreen, and she asks him if he's going to ask any questions. He asks if she wants him to. She doesn't yet. But she has a question for him. He says he'll answer as long as she stops calling him Sir. She asks what he'd like to be called instead, and he doesn't care, so we get a full page of her looking up at him, calling him by his first name. Unfortunately, when they land, they're greeted by a man who calls Kazuhiko Prince, not Sir or Kazuhiko, and he hates that, even though the man who we've met before, he has stubble and tiny sunglasses and a dissolute expression, and was reviewing that footage, thinks that Prince suits him so well. This is Bowles, and he left most of his troops behind fighting the Xiao Mao. That means kitten, by the way, just like Xiao Dan is little wolf. Xiao Mao's little kitty. Okay. But he searched all the transports to find the two of them himself, because while the Azaean army wants her, he just wants to play with Kazuhiko. There's some banter, and we get hints that the wizards, that's the five old folks on the parliamentary council, also control the underground, as well as we assume the government, though that is unclear at this point, to be honest.
What is clear is that Bowles has a creepy sadist thing for Kazuhiko, taunting him by telling him that he sleeps with his severed hand every night. Kazuhiko makes him take the fight to an alley so no innocent people get hurt, and he does get a good slash in on Bowles' face. But this is a distraction. Some of Bowles' goons grab Sue. Kazuhiko was on the ground, trapped between what I can only describe as Bowles' two lightsabers, and he lets Bowles stab him through the shoulder with one so he can get a good shot with his own weapon module, which is transformed into a beam weapon, to take out the soldiers who had Sue. He demands she run, but she just stands there with the suitcase, staring at him. Another goon might have gotten her, only he's taken out by a stab from behind. It's Gengetsu!
Kazuhiko wakes up in a nondescript room with Sue and Gengetsu hovering nearby. Lan tracked him down just in time for Gengetsu's rescue, it seems. He was knocked out by basically Bull's swords having a taser setting, so that sucks. Gengetsu gives Kazuhiko some painkillers for his crazy shoulder wound and leaves him alone. Kazuhiko wonders why Sue didn't run when he told her to. She says she didn't want to leave him. We get a full page of Kazuhiko with a sad, gentle expression telling her, wide-eyed, concerned little face, to save that for when she falls in love. She's worried she said something wrong, but that's not what he meant. Since he's shirtless, his current wound and his old ones are visible. She points out an old scar. He says that one's healed already. She traces a finger across his chest, not exactly seductively, more like a plotter on a map, and points to his heart. How about that one? He catches her hand in his own, the one with the weapons module, and says, "Who knows?"
Gengetsu comes back, and Kazuhiko tries to chase Sue out of the room subtly by saying he needs to get dressed, and jokes about her staying to watch when she doesn't immediately take the hint. She seems slightly confused that he doesn't want her to stay, but he professes he's shy, and she gives them space. Gengetsu wants Kazuhiko to remember that, quote, "what he said when he was Kazuhiko's deputy is still in effect, though we don't know what that is. Kazuhiko is trying to be glib, though, chiding Gagetsu for checking in on him just because he was bored and needing to go home and spend more time with Lan instead of just working. Two of them share a bit of a moment, but then Gagetsu gives him a futuristic car key, telling him that Bowles is monitoring all the transportation routes.
Kazuhiko drives them in a fancy car that we only just glimpse. The radio tells them that traffic is diverted because of an explosion. Sue considers the little branch of blossoms given to her by their friends in the Xiaomao, who definitely caused that explosion. The radio also plays the song, and Sue sings along. For pages, we just get darkness or paper white with song lyrics and the same fairy statue singing, shots of the blossoming branch, little shots of the characters' faces while they talk. So many lines repeating, I wish for happiness, I seek happiness, take me far away from here. Kazuhiko guesses that Sue is not happy. She asks why he'd say that, and he replies that the girl who sang that song was not happy. Sue asks if he loved her, and he doesn't say no, but now she's dead. Sue asks her name because she loves her songs. Kazuhiko reluctantly replies Oruha, but doesn't know how Sue could have possibly heard any of her songs. She was never a big star. Sue insists she knows her, though. Kazuhiko asks how she could, living alone in that greenhouse, but Sue doesn't answer. The lyrics on the page are, Retrace my broken future, take me away. And Sue says she's not happy now. She hasn't reached her destination. On a page mostly taken up with a big black panel, using ink to block out the interior of the car, so Sue and her tiny window to the smears of city lights seem especially small and lonely, Kazuhiko asks if she'll be happy when she gets there. And she admits she doesn't know, but she hopes so.
Meanwhile, Gengetsu checks in with General Cole. She says Azaya isn't the only one after Sue, so she'd like him to keep an eye on them. Gengetsu, using his visor as a VR phone, tells her that Kazuhiko knows he's involved. And Cole is unbothered by this, since she knew he would meddle even if it wasn't an order. She says that as lucky as Kazuhiko has been so far, this girl is a matter of national security, even more powerful than the boy Gengetsu is harboring. The page is scattered with skeletal leaves like the one imprinted on Kazuhiko's palm in the beginning. And isolated alone on a black page with one panel showing an overhead fan, one last narration box from Ko tells us that she never knew a four-leaf clover existed until now.
Kazuhiko and Sue are bedding down for the night in a nicer hotel than they've had access to so far, and Kazuhiko busies himself adding tripwires over the doors and windows in case Bowles decides to risk public attention by battling the hotel security to invade them. He says this isn't his norm, but his roommate is just so popular. She doesn't seem to get that he's joking, and informs him that they're not after her because they like her. The idea of being liked, having friends, seems to both intrigue and pain Sue, because she seemed a little maudlin before, when Kazuhiko told her about how Gengetsu and Lan were together, and now, when she asks if he and Gengetsu are friends, she has a similar expression. He's evasive, but doesn't say no. They're old military associates. Then Sue asks if that man has something damaged inside his head, and it's a little ambiguous to me whether she means Gengetsu or Bowles, but either way, Kazuhiko doesn't seem to know how to answer either. He tells her to get some sleep. He can stay up and keep watch because he has stimulus to use while he's working. She insists she could stay up and watch so he can sleep, but he doesn't take her up on the offer. She loves sleep because when she sleeps, she can forget she's alone. She looks out the wire-crossed window at the fairy lady statue, the one that has clover written across it. Kazuhiko gives her a gentle push back down onto the bed, promising he'll wake her up if he gets sleepy after all. She seems relieved and asks another question. Was he sad when Oruha died? Did he cry? Yes, and probably yes.
Falling back on the pillows, Sue says that when she dies, no one will cry for her. And when he asks why, she explains simply that it's because she's alone. He gives her gloved hand a squeeze with his own, leaving us to sit with the contradiction between how she feels and what we're seeing. The next two pages show the wire from the trap in the background, swirling across the white expanse as Sue offers him a last few words and presses her cheeks to their clasped hands. She says that Oruha had a very gentle voice, and she sang the song at concerts often. The lyrics here are the more intimate, soaked feathers, fingers locked, the warmth of skin, two hearts. And then the familiar, take me away, I wish for happiness, I seek happiness. And Kazuhiko wishes her a good night before she finally gives him a tiny sleepy smile and closes her eyes. Kazuhiko remarks to himself that they need to get to Fairy Park before he runs out of stimulant, which he applies to his neck with a visual that looks like someone giving themselves a cigarette burn. He looks down at the leaf imprinted on his palm, musing that he's alone, too. Outside, the fairy statue looks pretty lonely against the skyline.
In an armored vehicle somewhere outside, and with a heavily armed escort, Bulls, who has a lot of bandages over his trunk since Gingetsu skewered him, figures that if Gingetsu is nearby, then Kazuhiko and Sue are the real deal, not just a decoy as he'd feared. He hates Gingetsu. He's not a cute boy like Kazuhiko who he would prefer to play with. If you guess he was licking up the blood from the cut Kazuhiko left on his cheek from the earlier encounter, you would be right. He urges his men forward so they can intercept his prince.
But in the next scene, it's some other goons in black, these ones with visors, not helmets like Bull's troops, who start crashing through the hotel windows, only somewhat slowed by the wires, waking up Sue and slicing the pillows into a cloud of feathers. Kazuhiko remarks that these guys aren't Azean soldiers and brings out his giant bird-like sword weapon. Their weapons are similar and seem to overpower or disrupt his, which is no good. So he uses the wires to cut and garrot instead. They're black ops, like Gingetsu is, like he used to be. He figures they're here to do something to him and to Sue, and then just cover it up. They're backed into a corner and his weapons are ineffective, but then Sue grabs his hand and pulls him out the window with her. For a whole page, we see them plummeting, with her in front of him looking fearless. And then there's a sequence of panels where we watch shard-like wings emit from her back. The final shot is those wings materialized into a grand, full-size version of the jewelry-like ones we saw her wearing at the very beginning.
Ah, so we're left with so many mysteries!
I know!
What is a four-leaf clover? What can Sue do that makes her so important? How does she know Kazuhiko's ex? What made Kazuhiko leave the military? What's up with Gingetsu and Lan? Who can we trust? Why does Sue want to go to Fairy Park, and what is waiting for her there? Is it happiness? What even is happiness for her?
Yeah, so much. And I mean, I think I'm just going to launch into some of my general impressions here. Okay, first, this is the prettiest clamp art has ever been, and probably ever will be, in my opinion.
Agreed. And that is neck and neck with Holic, and one tier above Shidahime Sho for me. The artwork is so beautifully done. There's such a great contrast between the kind of photo-bashing work with the repeated imagery of, like, the fairy singing, and then the delicate facial expressions, detailed outfits, stark, minimalistic page layouts. How are the layouts working for you, Lucy?
The visual storytelling is just so cinematic. The world feels very real around them. There's clearly a whole culture going on, and we're only getting, like, snippets, and, like, sometimes literally, like, visually just snippets.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the story is very small. Like Sue, we only know what we're seeing, except obviously she knows much more than we do. I also found it very hard to stop at the volume cut, especially in the ominous hardcover I'm reading, which doesn't actually denote volume breaks, and I had to like use my old volumes to figure out where I was supposed to stop.
That's kind of fun. Like, that is an interesting experience to read this as like a straight through, just like ongoing sequence. Like, that's got to be a very flowy, almost meditative like experience to read it this way.
Yeah,
but also like that cliffhanger. Like, what a way to end that. We're just getting a taste in this volume of what's going on and who anyone even is. It is really cinematic. It's very music video specifically, with the song lyrics overtaking so many pages, overlaid onto repeated imagery or moments that are simply to get you to notice details, draw parallels. Like that moment halfway through where it's just these two facing pages with lyrics, showing a repeated shot of Lan touching his shoulder and Sue's band on her leg. Like, if you're reading it for the first time, you don't know why your attention is being drawn to those images, but if you keep reading, you'll figure it out. When you're making comics, you have a lot of options for how to use visuals to tell the story. Sometimes people treat them very literally, showing you as realistic and complete an illustration as they can manage for each story beat that they come up with, almost like you're taking screenshots from a movie. Comics like that can be really hard to read, even though they sound simple and obvious, because you don't know where to focus. It can be overwhelming to look at. But Clover has little panels that show these tiny glimpses, like I just said, right? Directing your attention to only what you can see. It uses negative space to create so much impact. Sometimes clamp action scenes are really hard to interpret. They use gorgeous art and wonderful poses that are really visually arresting. because they're such fabulous commercial artists, but that can kind of obscure the broader action happening. Or there are just so many effects lines and swooshes that it's hard to tell what direction the swooshing is going in. They're trying to do a lot with a little in Clover, so it's possible to simply miss things because you're not sure what they mean or why you're seeing them, or because you're looking for a piece of information that they're leaving ambiguous, but it largely flows well and the ambiguity is largely on purpose. The minimalism, the stark contrast, they're really different from Cardcaptor Sakura and really poignant in Clover.
Speaking of differences from Cardcaptor Sakura, I think one thing that impressed me as a teen is that Clover is really real about sex stuff. Like, Kengetsu is obviously in a sexual relationship with Dawn, and Kazuhiko has iffy feelings about the age difference. Bowles is also pretty overtly flirting with Kazuhiko while also being a creepy sadist, and the story is not hiding that from you. That is part of why I think this world feels gritty despite the art being very clean and pretty, and that and some of the techniques they use on viewer screens and stuff to make things feel kind of run down.
Yeah, I'm 100% there with you. This feels grown up in a lot of ways that their other works just don't. The Frank sexuality also contrasts really nicely with how isolated and sterile so much of the comic feels and how chaste Sue and Kazuhiko have been with each other so far. It is so different from Cardcaptor Sakura. like, tonally, my god. It actually reminds me of how when I'm working on a picture book, I'm usually also working on, like, a horror story or something at the same time, flexing different muscles so I can keep both the kid-friendly and more mature sides of my brain going.
Yeah, call back to our earlier point about how Clamp frequently had lighter and darker series in production at the same time.
Yeah.
So the art and storytelling is beautiful, but sometimes I am having trouble knowing who is talking or, kind of like you alluded to, following the action.
Yeah, and I feel like I talked enough about why it is sometimes hard to follow action in Clamp stuff, but the dialogue. reading very closely in order to do the summary that I did, because I wrote the summary this time, usually Lucy does that, I could tell reading it this closely that the dialogue is almost always sorted out eventually, but it can be a little tricky to tell who is talking because they often just show a tailless bubble on a black background and you have to figure it out from context. And while the translation's pretty great, it would probably be easier to understand who was talking in Japanese, where Kazuhiko and Sue would use drastically different language. He's an ex-military badass, she's a sheltered young girl.
Yeah, I kept thinking about how I wished this was an anime so I could hear their different voices and interpret, like, the Japanese speech patterns that one of them I can understand anyway.
Yeah. There's actually an exchange I glossed over the summary that has baffled me for 20 years. So I looked at various translations and consulted friends. Thank you, Natalie Slaughter of Art Over Flowers and OG Old Taku, as she would put it, and also Andrea Gilroy of the Eugene Books with Pictures comic shop. And also Emily C. Martin of Princeless. Thanks, guys. You all worked really hard with me. Only to find out, as I did all this research, that where the translation lost me was not the part that had stood out to me the whole time. When we first meet Kengetsu and Lan, here's the dialogue. It just cold opens on this.
So we're going to perform this as a very uncomfortable skit. Let's go.
Kengetsu. I'm Kengetsu here, sorry. I'm Kengetsu, Lucy's Kazuhiko. It's not true, but deal with it. So your tastes have changed? I thought you hated kids.
How about I make you my bitch?
Run that by me again?
I said I'll make you my bitch, Kengetsu.
And then Lan butts in to say that when Kengetsu first brought him home, Kazuhiko called Kengetsu a child molester. Kazuhiko asserts that Lan was just a child 2 years ago, which we're left to wonder about. Is that literal? An exaggeration? A description of his maturity? We will find out eventually. And by the way, Lan steps back, I was still older than this child, referring to Sue, who to me looks somewhere between, I don't know, she could be anywhere between 13 and 23, because she's anime age. Like, how am I supposed to know?
Yeah.
Her eyes are enormous, I can't tell, she's a bug monster, like, whatever. Anyway, I think our performance of it might help clarify a little, because, like, I always found that to be such an out-of-the-blue escalation. What the fuck, Kazuhiko? but it's actually really close to the original text. It's not the exact phrasing, but they had there was like a very spicy, foul-mouthed kind of response. And to be honest, I think I would have used fuck off and die or eat my dick or something, even though the original, like, was way closer to, like, I'm gonna make you my bitch. That's really close to what the original actually said, but it, like, was a little confusing. I was like, it just feels like such an intense escalation from a pretty content-free thing that Gingetsu starts with, only to finally realize my confusion actually stems because the translation toned down what Gingetsu let in with. I had never read it as him hinting that Kazuhiko was being a creeper for bringing Sue. I honestly read it as, like, not what is, like, said you hate kids, right? Like, I didn't assume that the opposite of hating kids was wanting to have sex with them, because I don't think that's a great, like, that anyone would assume that. But yeah, it should be more clear, like, considering how much shit Gingetsu gives back to him, it should be more clear Gingetsu was talking major shit to him in the first place. And the original Japanese does make that way more clear. Because the scene is literally two salty old soldiers giving each other shit. Lol, you into kids now, perv? Eat my entire dick, Gingetsu. Your boyfriend is like four. Is pretty much what we're going, like, that's pretty much what the dialogue actually is, which is way more frank and gritty than we usually get with Clamp. while looking into this, Emily C. Martin of Princeless and Mega Moth fame, and whose podcast, Progressively Horrified, I'm about to guest on, so I guess we can plug that here. That's really fun. Track down her Italian copy, and in Italian, the exchange goes more like, oh, so you're into kids now? No, you're more my type, Gingetsu, an old man. Which, like, that takes way more liberties from the original, but I think it carries the meaning pretty clearly. It makes it clear they're just giving each other shit.
Yeah, major thank you to you and your intrepid friends for tracking this down. This scene has actually always confused me, too, and as a teen, I just assumed I was, like, too young to get it. And now I know!
Okay. So, Lon is, I think, my actual favorite Clamp boy. I mean, like, if I had, like, a hotness tier list, I think... like, me, and certainly was, like, when I was young. Like, I'm not sure. I have to think about that. Have my taste changed? But I think he still is the prettiest to me. And it's all in the details. I love the detail where, like, his tennis shoes are all scrunched down in the heel because he just, like, doesn't untie them to put his shoes on. And that just feels so incredibly real to me. Like, that's such an intimate detail. He's also kind of, like, stands with a slight hunch, and he's always touching that one spot on his back. It looks like he's never slept, and apparently that's great for me. And I don't just mean, like, oh, this is my type. I mean, I think that he is sold to me as this very real living person in a way that not every Clamp character is for me. There's so much more about him later. This is just a glimpse, but I think he stands out. Sue is also incredibly pretty in a fairly unique way. Other than her eyes, she looks nothing like a character from Cardcaptor Sakura or really anything else they've done. Maybe a little bit Yuzuriha. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe a little bit like her. But she, I don't know, what she really reminds me of is a Danke Murata drawing, only even prettier, and despite how often they call her a child, she actually feels less creepily underaged than his highly rendered nymphettes.
Yeah, Sue really stands out to me as different from any other Clamp protagonist, but I think we'll have to dive into that more once we've finished the series, because my sense of kind of what makes her different hasn't really solidified. Like, I think you're right, and I have a sense of it, but I need to know more first.
Yeah, definitely. We need to know more before we should, I mean, like, also to avoid stargazing, we should not.
Also that.
Yeah. So this maybe belonged in our opening crawl of background info, but, like, when I said, but that thing was long. Sorry, guys. My background info for Clover is, like, here's a short treatise on... cyberpunk, and, like, God, who even needs it? Anyway, when I said Clover is a Y2K cyberpunk comic, I meant it. And I'm trying to think about, like, what do I mean? At the time, when it came out, because, like, I read it in 2001, right? It was very, like, it felt fresh and contemporary with its twisting of high-tech and baroque organic imagery. I do think it handles that in a really unique way visually. But while a lot of cyberpunk that we use to define this very undefinable sliver of sci-fi subculture, genre, style, literature, whatever it is, from the very early 80s and even late 70s, really speculating on the future influenced by often dystopian interconnectivity through computers and technology, Clover's from the era when we were worried about the Y2K bug and when the internet was taking over in people's lives, so it's speculating even further into the future, into a more lyrical, poetic, abstract space. I will always link Clover with the anime Serial Experiments Lane, because I, you know, experienced them at the same time in like 2001 or whatever, and I think it's fair, even though they are very, very different. I mean, they are both Japanese Y2K cyberpunk series about wide-eyed lonely girls who struggle with connections, and that I think those are very relevant things to people, even today. They are very different. Clover is more romanticized. I mean, it's more of a romance. Sue is definitely in the bodyguard fantasy wish fulfillment zone, not the Chunibyo end of Evangelion godhead zone like Lane is, but there's a link there that might be fun for people to explore if you want to vibe with the Y2K anxieties and look back at early internet culture. Also, I should just mention, Sue is Chinese for four, by the way. My pronunciation sucks, but I am pronouncing her name as it is in Japanese, which is Sue. I think the kanji they use for lan is the one for orchid, but I need to double check because maybe there is some other imagery in there that I'm missing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, obviously four is because four leaf clover, but there is also this whole like unlucky connotation to the number four in Japanese, from what I understand, because it can be pronounced the same way as the word for death, she. I wonder if there's like a double meaning there at all, and I guess we'll have to wait and see, which is not me being coy. I honestly don't remember.
Yeah, we often gloss over clamp names. Not always, but we often do because like they are really carefully chosen, and sometimes they're kind of obvious, and sometimes they're like clearly very important to clamp, but a little, and like maybe even reveal plot details, but not until you know. And because I am just not fluent in, especially not in reading kanji, I'm going to miss a lot of that stuff. And sometimes that stuff is discussed in the story. And sometimes it's just like, it's maybe obvious enough that a reader is just going to get it. And like, I feel like I'm always missing a little glimpse of some of this stuff by not getting as deeply into that as I should. I have heard that some people think that clamp names are kind of weird, or that they pick weird kanji or something, but I just, like, I don't quite know what they mean by that. So in this case, I just happen to know that this one is like you wouldn't write the Chinese word for four SU or SUU or SUE. So, like, you wouldn't write it that way. You write it more like she. But I'm sorry, my ability to pronounce Chinese is zero. I'm too confused. It's something I'd like to work on, like with Korean.
But
in this case, it's like, yeah, this is the first few numbers in Chinese and Japanese are almost exactly the same, but just different enough to make my brain implode.
All right. Well, on that note, imploding brains, I guess.
Brains imploding.
Yes. In our next episode, which will probably be in July, possibly June, depending on how our production schedule for it goes, we'll be discussing Volume 2 of Clover. Who could have guessed?
Until then, you can follow us on Twitter, Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Instagram at ClampCastPod, on Facebook as Clampcast in Wonderland, and on our website, clampcastinwonderland.com. We are not super active on social media at the moment. We're kind of clawing our way back from Lucy getting married times, which just like ate us for a while. But Lucy has been lurking and reposting on Twitter and Blue Sky now and then.
You can support us on Patreon by making purchases through our bookshop.org store, or just by writing a review or sharing this podcast with your anime-liking friends. Reviews in Apple Podcasts are especially helpful, supposedly. That's what everyone says, anyway.
Thanks for coming with us on our journey through Clamp's Wonderland.
Until next time, remember that everything will definitely be all right.
And try not to lose an eye.